are going to attempt to wrap up our discussion about Herod and his family. We started this 2 weeks ago. Do you have this from 2 weeks ago? If you do not, raise your hand. Okay, so we've got a couple people who, well, one has a good excuse, you were out of town. All right, anybody? I got one extra. Make sure I have one. That would be a good idea. Yes, I do. Mine actually has notes on it. Haha. I get to cheat. Okay. We are going to be referring this to this quite a bit in this session because we'll be talking about the children of Herod at some point, and it'll start making sense if you have this in front of you. I also have a separate chart, but this particular one has a list of the players, the most important people, with a little bit of who they are in case you ever want to look at this a little more carefully. Some of the time I'll just pass it around this way and just enjoy trying to figure this out, because this has been so much fun. Believe it or not, there's actually now a book on Herod the Great. Just came out this year. It was actually very helpful to me in some of the more in-depth reading. Trying to read Josephus for any reason is a chore. So having other scholars make it a little more consumable is very helpful. It's by a guy named Norman Gelb, in case you're ever interested.
How does Josephus write? And what's it like?
It's a cure for insomnia. It's monotone history, and it's in very difficult translation in English and in very tiny print. So if you, I mean, I have the book of Josephus, books of Josephus, and you open it up, it's just this flood of, you know, 2,000 words on a page. It's just so hard to work through. And it's a wooden translation because the one that's out was done 100 years ago. And no one's really done a fresh translation and try to popularize it. So it's
volume.
Yeah. If you were to actually, you can buy it all in one, which I have. It's by $15, but it's all in one because of the tiny print. If you go to the Loeb Classics, I think it's 12 volumes. And it's the War of Antiquities and the War of the Jews. It's basically all of this history that we are studying comes from Josephus, pretty much. So, we have Herod. We established him last time, just to kind of get us in a running start for those of you who either don't remember or weren't here. The father of Herod was a guy named Antipater, who was an Idumean, which is the land of Edom. Antipater became was put in charge of Jerusalem after the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem. He basically came in and took charge. His son Herod took over after Antipater died. And this is during the time of Antony and Cleopatra and Octavius. So you have Octavius in Rome establishing his power. You have Mark Antony out gallivanting around the countryside with Cleopatra and creating all of that chaos. But they were the power base of Rome. The Parthians. Anybody want to tell me who the Parthians were? Anybody remember?
Greeks.
No, not Greeks. They're the ones on this part of the wall. Yeah. Iran, Iraq. Basically the Persians, the Babylonians of that time. All right. They were a powerhouse. They had, in fact, Julius Caesar, before he died, he was planning on leaving Rome to go conquer the Parthians. And because he was leaving on March, I think it was 16th, the conspiracy was to kill him before he left. So we have the Ides of March 2 days before he was supposed to leave to take care of the Parthians. So the Parthians have been a thorn in the side of the Romans for all this time. Well, they came in, they began conquering Syria and Judea. And we, for those of you who aren't used to my map, this is Judea, okay? Just imagine it. Babylon's over here, Rome and Greece is over here, and we can't use this board because the school won't let us. So we have this invisible gap. Actually, this would be Turkey, if you want to put it in map form. So the Parthians have come in, they push back the Romans. Because Herod is in charge, he has to leave town. He escapes with his family. They run off to Petra asking for sanctuary from the king of the southern region, but down in Arabia, now Saudi Arabia. And they're turned away because they're afraid of Rome. So he retreats back to Masada, sticks his family up on top of the mountain, and flees to Rome. When he gets to Rome, Herod appeals to the two rulers of Rome, who are Octavius and Mark Antony, and says, I am your leader of your country of Judea, and you need to give me support because the Parthians are knocking at our door. And they say, yes, you are an important person. In fact, we name you King of the Jews. And here are our Roman soldiers to go back and reconquer the region. So he eventually comes back. The Romans push back the Parthians. Mark Antony defeats them terribly and horribly, and very bad things happen to the Parthians, but they're gone from the picture now. Meanwhile, Herod takes over. In the interim, we have the whole Octavius-Mark Antony drama, which we have completed. Mark Antony and Cleopatra commit suicide, and Octavius is now the leader of all of Rome. He takes the moniker of Caesar, Caesar Octavius. Wait a minute, that isn't it. Well, at this time it was. He was Caesar Octavius, because we're around 30 BC. So you have Caesar's in power, Herod's in power, everything is set. This is the beginning of the golden era of both Herod and of Rome, because for the next 35 years or so, there is no attempt, well, I shouldn't say no attempt, but there is no successful attempt to kick either of them off of their position of power. So we have a golden era of that time. In 28 BC, the Senate changes Octavius's name and they give him the name Augustus, which means revered. So we now have Caesar Augustus, and that era of Rome, basically the Roman Empire as we know it today, was established.
Is there any connection between Octo is 8 and August is the 8th month of the year?
Actually, at the time, it wasn't the 8th month of the year. They changed it to name it after him. Julius, you missed that session. We talked about the Julian calendar. And the month of August was actually Sextus. And it was changed under Caesar Augustus' time to August or August, which is, and July is named after Julius.
Would Sextus be 6?
There was some god or something that they named it after. I don't remember, but that's the idea. So the calendar we have today, July is named after Julius Caesar, and August is named after Caesar Augustus. So we're celebrating that this month, Caesar Augustus month. Yeah, let's have a party. Let's have a bridal shower. How appropriate. Okay. Now, when Herod came back from Rome, he then goes, pulls his family off of the mountain of a Masada, and they wonderfully roll their way back into Jerusalem to establish themselves. And at the time, he was married to a woman named Miriam the First. You see on this chart, she's the second one from the left, because he had already gotten rid of Doris, his first wife. And notice the name of the son of Doris. That's Antipater, named after, obviously, granddad. This is what makes this so confusing. We have so many Herods, so many Philips, so many Salomes, so many Miriamnas, that it gets really confusing. So let's just, if you get confused, too bad, because I'm confused, and I'm the teacher, and I have gone over this so many times to try to drill it in my head. So we have, originally, Herod the Great is married to Doris. He gets rid of Doris, and yet they have a son named Antipater, who he still loves. He marries Miriamna the First. She's apparently very beautiful, just absolutely gorgeous. She is the granddaughter, as you can see on your chart, of John Hyrcanus. John Hyrcanus was one of the last of the Hasmoneans, or the Maccabean period, rulers. So there's the connection to the Jewish leadership and the Jewish establishment. So he has married the granddaughter of the Hasmonean Empire. This is important because they still... there was this anti-Roman element within the Judean people, within the Jewish people. But Herod is their ruler, and they have the daughter of John Hyrcanus is very close. So while Herod's gone, and Rome is, you know, rescuing the people, the revolutionary element continues to foment. And they appeal to Miriamna and her mother, whose name is Alexandra, and they decide that they need to get rid of Herod. Now, I hope you have a better relationship in your life, so that if you kind of have, well, let's conspire to get rid of Steve. There are days where I feel that that's happening, but that's not. What? What? So anyway, so there is a conspiracy going on. The Hasmoneans are rumbling. They're in cahoots with his wife Miriamna the First, and so much to his own chagrin, he executes her in 29 BC, and she is executed by strangulation, which is the way to get rid of royalty at this time. The mother steps up and declares herself queen of the Jews, which doesn't make Herod very happy. So he declares her mentally unfit, sticks her in a cell somewhere, and she is forgotten for all time. In 28 BC, Miriamna's brother steps into the fore, which we don't have him on our chart here. He shows up and he begins conspiring against Herod, so Herod has him executed. 27 BC, at this point, he had already built an amphitheater for games. And so they were going to have the inaugural, let's just call it the Judean Olympics, for lack of a better term. They were going to have the games. And the Hasmoneans thought the way to get rid of Herod is that he's going to be here. We know he's going to be here. You know, our spies are guaranteeing he's going to show up to inaugurate the games. And so they planned to attack his train, his caravan, I guess would be a better word. But one of the, somebody had loose lips, and so the conspiracy was discovered, and Herod had all of the conspirators gathered together, and they executed him at the beginning of the games. What's a great way to have a ribbon-cutting ceremony, metaphorically speaking. So they get rid of all that problem. Pretty much everyone's decided we don't need to try to assassinate Herod anymore because it ain't going to work. So they just pretty much leave him alone. He begins what we talked about at length last week, or 2 weeks ago, a very extensive building program throughout the countryside. And this was, in fact, some people call Herod the Great, Herod the Builder. He used extraordinary means to rebuild Masada. He built the amphitheater I mentioned. He built a temple to Caesar Augustus and named it the Augustus Temple, whatever. Augustus didn't like the fact that he was being declared a god, but he also didn't stop them. So he let it happen without, you know, endorsing it. And the religion of Rome began to spread throughout the empire. Rome became the god. You did things in the name of Rome. And if you think about our New Testament time, there was that sense of Rome was this extraordinary power, but it had a power that also had a religious hold on the people. And a lot of this was happening here during this time. He also built Caesarea Maritima, or Caesarea Maritime, which is a seaport. And then in Jerusalem, he rebuilt the temple of Solomon to extraordinary glory. We talked about this very briefly. One of the stones that has been measured that they found, it was 37 feet long, 12 feet high, and 18 feet wide. One stone. So that would fill this room and beyond. I mean, it's 37 feet would take us out into the courtyard somewhere. One big, huge limestone rock has been found. Now, I had promised that we would talk about this last time. We ran out of time doing it. Where in the world did he get the money to do all this?
Taxes.
Exactly. Taxes.
Poverty taxes for the rich.
Even now.
This is going to sound familiar. During the Hellenistic era, the Greeks used a system of tax farming, selling collection opportunities to the highest bidder. Herod the Great utilized this arrangement as well. He placed levies on everything, taxing people on their land, their crops, and even their animals. They had to pay poll taxes, travel taxes, and sale taxes from everything from food to slaves. Doesn't that sound familiar? Absolutely everything. The tax burden was crushing under the Romans, who refined the method by requiring people to register in the town of their birth, ding, the town of their birth, and by hiring chief collectors who determined tax quotas and sold franchises to the highest bidder. Those who bought the franchises, known as publicans, or tax farmers, were generally dishonest and greedy, cheating people by collecting even more than the government required and keeping the rest for themselves. Who was a publican that we know of in the New Testament?
Matthew
was a publican, but he was also an apostle, which is incredibly radical. The fact that he had one of those in his small group was extraordinary. Plus, we had Zacchaeus, who was the tax collector, and the fact that Jesus invited him down, saying, you know, I want to come to your house. Everyone around is going, what? You're actually going to talk to someone who works at the IRS? On purpose? And actually be nice to them? You can't do that. Roman and Jewish troops enforced the payment of taxes. When John the Baptist began his ministry, he challenged people to repent and be baptized. When tax collectors and soldiers asked what they should do, in Luke chapter 3, John said to the tax collectors, "Don't collect any more than you're required to." The Jews loathed tax collectors. The occasion for three parables in Luke 15 was the Pharisees' complaint that Jesus was eating with tax collectors and despicable sinners. In response to their criticism, Jesus, a friend of tax collectors, Luke 7, told three stories about God's infinite and unconditional love for the lost. So you have this economic system in place that was very repressive and unfair, and yet that's how they paid for everything. Kind of like Britain and their tax on tea. And the people rose up and they fought against it constantly. They were just, it was so much of a burden that it didn't make much sense. Well, while all that's going on, let me see, I got my pen here. Remember, he had killed off his wife, Mariamne, in 29 BC. So in 23 BC, you can actually put it next to Mariamne the second. He sees Mariamne the second, and she's gorgeous. But she is not of the right social standing. Her father is a Jewish priest. So Herod kicks the high priest out of the office and names Mariamne's father the high priest. And then he marries the high priest's daughter. So to create social status, he actually engineered her status by making his father-in-law the high priest before they got married. Things go along swimmingly, as you might say, in Herod's golden era. He has named, by 13 BC, let me erase some of all these dates, they don't, not going to have any more meaning here. Herod names Antipater as his heir. Now, find Antipater on your chart. He is in the top left under Doris. So this is his first son, his oldest son. He names Antipater as his heir. There are two other sons in place right now. You can just go right to the, just to the right, one column, and find Alexander and Aristobulus. These are the sons of Mariamne, who he had already killed. So, but they're still alive. In 12 BC, Herod suspects that Alexander and Aristobulus are conspiring to get rid of him. And they also figure, the rumor was that they were also going to kill Antipater, so that they would have the power of their father. He has them arrested. Herod arrests both Alexander and Aristobulus, has them arrested. The charge of conspiracy has a sentence of execution on it. It's a death sentence. But you cannot execute at this level without the okay of Caesar. So Herod sends a letter to Caesar Augustus saying, you know, I got some bad blood in my family. I need to get rid of it and excise it. And Caesar goes, no, just work it out. Work it out. Can't we all just get along? So Caesar Augustus steps in and forces them to reconcile. We know this happened because in 12 BC, Herod added Alexander and Aristobulus to his will as positions 2 and 3. So Antipater's number 1, Alexander's number 2, Aristobulus is number 3 in the succession order. and you think things are going to go along just fine and swimmingly. 9 BC. The Nabataeans come into play. And you go, who are the Nabataeans? I don't even know that name. What is going on here? The Nabataeans, remember we've got Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Jerusalem. The Nabataeans are down here. Alright, so there, this tribe on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, they began making some problems. And if you know where Masada is, it's right next to the Dead Sea. So I drew it up here, in much smaller scale, a tiny little Sea of Galilee, and there's your Dead Sea. Masada's about right here. Jerusalem's up here. So if his winter home, his nice little palace down here in Masada, he knows the Nabataeans are right on the other side of the ocean there, or the Dead Sea. I really wish I could take all of you to Israel and you could see this, because when you stand on the shore of the Dead Sea, you can see the other side. It's not that big. It's like when we went to the Sea of Galilee, it's a lake. It's not a sea. I was so disappointed. I got off the bus and stood on this mountainside, and there's this tiny little pond called the Sea of Galilee. I went, you jog around this thing. Well, not really, but it wasn't that large. So the scale, we have these impressions in our head. When you actually see it, it's not that far.
Is that the one where the storm?
Yes.
Yeah,
the Sea of Galilee. Basically, imagine a big lake, and if the wind comes up, and you're stuck out in the middle of the lake without a motor.
But not like the Great Lakes.
They're not that big, but it's still pretty dangerous. I mean, there's shipwrecks all the time in the Sea of Galilee with the wind catches the fishermen.
I've been on Canyon Lake when a windstorm came up suddenly, and I was terrified because we were in a little
dinghy?
A little, with just a sail on it. We quickly put the sail down and tried to paddle to shore. I was really scared.
Really?
It was unbelievable. I know we were just on Canyon Lake. It's not a very big lake.
See, it's all a matter of perspective. If you've got an engine, and you're fine. But if you're without a way to get out of the storm, it can create white caps. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the water's whipping up and knocking you around. Anyway, Nabataeans. The Nabataeans are rattling their sabers. So Herod broke what was called the Pax Augusta, or Augustine's Peace. Pax Romana, we've heard of. Pax Augusta. And he had announced peace throughout all the empire. No one's supposed to fight anybody else without his approval. Herod broke it by attacking the Nabataeans. They must have raided something somewhere, and he got it in himself that he was going to take care of it. Well, Augustus got wind of this breaking of the peace and was very angry at Herod. So angry that he refused to listen to any communication from Herod. He basically cut him off from all support for 2 full years. This was a pretty big deal. We don't know much about in history what the impact was, but Herod eventually was thoroughly cowed by the separation. I mean, you can say, how many times do I have to apologize? Yeah.
So Herod was getting his portion of the tax money from Rome.
And
so
certainly
he
was.
All the tax money.
Well, who knows? Because he's collecting Roman taxes in his area. He probably gets some share. Whatever, he gets cut off, and it's not a good thing. This is a problem. Well, he finally gets back together, but not until, remember, we got 2 years. In 8 BC, this is what makes this interesting. Alexander and Aristobulus are arrested again for conspiracy to kill their father. Does he appeal to Augustus? Well, he really can't. Augustus isn't listening to him. So, they are brought to court, in a Roman court, and they are found guilty in 7 BC. By this point, Herod finally says, you know, I've already upset Augustus once. I cannot actually execute my sons without Augustus's answer. And Augustus finally lifted the embargo, welcomed him back. Well, probably they negotiated a settlement of some sort. And Augustus said, well, if they've already been found guilty, go ahead and execute them. So in 7 BC, Herod kills his two sons. So he's executed his wife. He's taken his mother-in-law and put her in a cell somewhere after declaring her mentally unstable. He has his will changed again. He obviously takes Alexander and Aristobulus out of the will, and he names Philip. If you look on your chart, we're now in the third column under Mariamne II, Herod Philip as the heir. By the way, he had 10 wives. You only see 5 of them here, because these are the only 5 ones we really care about in history. But yeah, he kind of had his harem going on.
How many of the 10 did he kill?
Just the 2.
What happened to Antipater?
Antipater.
He's still around. He's number one in the will. He's still in the will. So you have Antipater's number one, Philip is number 2. And we are at 7 BC. By the way, our countdown is to get to 4 BC when he dies. So you can kind of see the anticipation of why I'm slowing this down. Because these are these final years of Herod.
Which 2 did he kill again?
Alexander and Aristobulus.
And which wives?
He killed Mariamne the first and got rid of his mother-in-law, her mother. So he's killed 3 of them so far.
But only one wife so far? Did he kill Doris?
I don't think he... Did he kill Doris?
I don't know. I thought you said he killed 2 wives, but I don't know.
Oh, let's find out here. Let's get back to Doris. I do have it in my notes somewhere. For those of you listening on the tape, I can't find it. Divorced her. Yeah, I didn't think he killed her. He just put her aside. Yeah. Look it up on Wikipedia. They always tell the truth. Actually, it is quite an amazing encyclopedia where you can at least get a general sense that it's probably close enough for initial information. So now we have the will changed. Antipater is first, Philip is second. Then comes 5 BC. Around 5 BC or so, maybe a little earlier, Herod begins having health problems. I read some rather horrific descriptions of the nature of his illness. Best way to describe it was a form of intestinal cancer that had all sorts of horrific implications. I mean, his nether regions would have worms. He would have excruciating pain. He'd suddenly start bleeding from his mouth. I mean, it was just terrible. And of course, back then, they didn't have MRIs and other things. They just keep trying to treat him and try to keep him from having pain. He would he would move from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is much further down in the valley, by about 400, 500 feet. So it was warmer down in the valley in an attempt to keep him comfortable during the winter months. They would take him to Masada, and he would bathe in the Dead Sea because of the salt, kind of salt baths, an attempt to try to assuage his pain and to cool him. And if you ever have, again, if you ever go to the Holy Land and you have the opportunity to go in the Dead Sea, do it. There are a few in our tour that were brave enough to actually go in. I just put my hand in it.
Oh, I went in it.
You've been in it. You actually went all the way in.
Oh, yeah, I put on a bathing suit and went right in.
Oh, you're brave.
Floated all over.
You can't sink.
You
no matter what, you cannot sink. Well, I remember putting my hand in, and then I just stood like this for the next few minutes to let it dry. And it was completely white.
Yeah.
And then went like that, and the salt just broke off. It was amazing. So
they have showers there outside that you can stand under after.
Oh, okay. Otherwise, you're a little crusty on the bus. Yeah, you'd be your own pillar of salt, exactly. So he's trying all these things to try to, you know, help him with his pain. So he knows his end is near. So this is why he becomes obsessed with having his heirs set up properly. So Antipater, he's kind of grooming him and everything else. And then in 5 BC, Antipater is charged with an attempted assassination of Herod. And from what I've been able to read, these accusations were pretty accurate. You know, in other words, yeah, I know you're getting old, Dad, but you're grumpy and you're angry all the time because of your illness. Why don't we just put you out of your misery so I can take over and try to do it sooner than waiting till later? He is charged with an assassination. He is brought before the court, and he is found guilty. And was stuck in jail waiting for Augustus to render sentence of death or not. In early 4 BC, the pain and the suffering of Herod has escalated to a much higher level. In fact, consistently, there were rumors that he had died, because he would cry out so loud in pain, screaming in this palace, and then it would go silent because he either passes out from the pain or whatever, and so then the servants behind the walls or whatever, they go up, and next thing you know, the rumors that Herod is dead, and then they wake up the next day and know he's not. So you have this problem in the communication of really what's going on with Herod. Well, one Pharisee decided that this was a good time to establish their rebellion against Rome and against Herod. So he gets a group of young men and says, you know, Herod is weak, but we need to make a statement. And over the front of the temple court, on the entrance to the court, not inside, but on the entrance to the temple, Herod had placed a golden eagle, which is the symbol of Rome. This was the thing they would have on their standard when they would want march into battle. The Pharisees, the religious leaders, felt this was an idolatrous representation, and they felt it needed to come down. But to do so would obviously have violent repercussions. So they chose this moment while Herod is weak. And he convinced these young men, saying, even if you are caught, it will be worth it to die to tear this thing down. So in the middle of the night, these young men steal into the courtyard, climb up on the walls, and they tore it down, smashed it to pieces, They should have just stolen it because they never would have been found. But they smashed it to pieces in the courtyard, and the noise attracted the soldiers. Soldiers came in and arrested these guys, and these young men were burned to death by Herod's order for their desecration of his temple and his material. The people were not happy about this. Augustus finally gets the call that Antipater has been made guilty of an attempted assassination. And in 4 BC, Antipater is strangled. 5 days later, Herod dies. But before he died, he changed the will one more time. So get out your chart, because this is really confusing. Notice that there are two Herod Philips. Column 3 under Mariamne II is Herod Philip. Column 5 under Cleopatra, this is not the Cleopatra of Egypt, she's dead. This is a Cleopatra of Jerusalem, just happened to have the same name. She has a son of Herod called Herod Philip. They are two different people. Yeah, I know they have the same name. And Thanksgiving must have been really confusing. But they are two very different people. When Herod made the final change to his will, he drops Herod Philip in the third column completely and names as his heir Archelaus. And Archelaus is in the fourth column under Malthace. So you have Malthace had two sons, Antipas and Archelaus. And he names Archelaus as the heir to his throne. Also, because he was so paranoid and he knew everybody was trying to kill him, and he knew that the people would actually have a celebration when he died, he took all of the favorite Jewish leaders of the region, arrested them all, brought them to the hippodrome, put them in cells, and had Roman soldiers in front of each cell that as soon as the news of Herod's death was announced, they were to go into the cells and kill each one of these favorite men, so that everyone would be mourning when he died. Not celebrate. I mean, this guy was nasty. We also happen to remember that in 4 BC, wise men from the east came to visit, saying, "We are looking for the one born king of the Jews." This is in 4 BC. His sons are trying to kill him. He is full of gut cancer. He is kind of out of his mind. And he's the king of the Jews. He was named the king of the Jews 30 years ago by Caesar Augustus himself. And these Parthians from the east come into his area and say, "We're looking for the one born king of the Jews." And he goes, "What do you mean? That's me." Now you understand. What?
But he wasn't born king.
No, he wasn't born. That's the thing. He's going, "Who is this person?" Exactly. And so he says, "Well, once you find him, come back and tell me. Wouldn't that be nice?" And of course they don't. So he has the slaughter of the innocents to try to get rid of whoever this child is. That's what's going on behind the scenes. So Herod dies. Jesus is born. Herod dies. We have Archelaus is supposed to be the king. But Caesar Augustus does not want that to happen. So he decides to split the Judean kingdom into three parts. And he names Herod Antipas. So if you look in your chart, under Malthace, you have Herod Antipas, Herod Archelaus, and Herod Philip are the three who are put in charge. So you have three tetrarchs instead of one. Herod Antipas is given Galilee. Archelaus is given Judea and Samaria. And Philip, it says here, you can see it, says Iturea and all these other lovely names that you have no idea where they are. Well, you take the Sea of Galilee. Philip had all this area up here, which would, in today's world, would be Syria. So Herod Antipas is the Herod of the New Testament. When Jesus is in his ministry, the Herod that is spoken of in the New Testament is this Herod Antipas. Archelaus, remember, he was the one who was named in the will, and he probably knew that. So he probably resented his brother and his cousin, or his half-brother, that'd be more accurate, his half-brother, as also having territory. So he's in charge of Jerusalem, Samaria, and Idumea, the homeland down in Edom. He was such a jerk and such a really bad ruler that in, have it here, in 6 AD, Archelaus is removed from the rulership by Caesar Augustus and banished to Gaul. They stuck him as far away in the Roman kingdom as they could. Now, another thing that happened in 4 BC when Herod died. Let me write it over here. There's a little bit of unknown bit of history. This is what I wrote on the board is Judas the Galilean in 4 BC. Judas the Galilean was the son of a robber baron named Hezekiah, who Herod had killed 20 years earlier. Judas the Galilean was a ruffian. He started what later became known as the Zealots. And in 4 BC, up in a little town called Sepphoris, if I have it right here, which is right next to Nazareth, maybe 5 miles down the road from Nazareth, so up in the upper part of Galilee, he raids the armory in this town, takes all the weapons, arms his fellow men, and they go out in the countryside and begin rampaging and killing Romans and creating a big, big mess. For 10 years, this guy created problems all throughout the region. They begin calling him a Messiah. They begin saying that he was going to overthrow Rome and that they really had high hopes with him. But it finally got to the point that in 6 BC, the Romans hunted him down and killed him and killed all of his band of merry men and then went into the town of Sepphoris. And
is that going backwards?
6 AD.
Sorry.
I keep doing that. Even my notes are written that way. And even went to the town where he had raided the armory and killed 2,000 people, women, children, knocked everything down, and the Romans said, there will be no more revolt. We're getting rid of this guy. So, if you think about it, when Jesus was 10 years old, this revolt was put down just a few miles from where they were living. And the town, Sepphoris, was rebuilt by Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas rebuilt that town and needed carpenters. And so there is a theory that Jesus may have spent some of his youth rebuilding this town, and the stories of the revolt was going on. Now, why am I saying this? Because there's a new book out that, have you heard of this book? Called Zealot?
Yeah, it's by
Muslim.
Yeah.
A Muslim by the name of Reza Aslan.
Oh, he used to be an evangelical Christian. He's switched over to
a very evil person.
Yeah, well, let me just put it this way. This book is the number one bestseller in America right now because of a Fox News interview that was wasn't very well informed, but it went viral because the interviewer tried to get him to say that this was a Muslim view of Jesus when it isn't. He happens to be a Muslim. But when you read the book, there's no Muslim picture of Jesus in here. It is simply liberal scholarship. So I've read through much of this. The bottom line that this guy is saying in here is that Jesus was not the Messiah. Jesus was a zealot. A follower of Judas the Galilean. And that when he was crucified, he was because he was fighting against the establishment. And it was Paul who created the divine Christ. And that's in this book. And it's the number one bestseller in America right now.
And if you want to know more about the author, to see how acceptable of a person you're talking about, the highest mind level of kind of land, he really was an evangelical Christian. That's a myth.
No, he claimed to be, I guess.
Yeah, he claimed to be. Yeah, he claimed to be.
Anything he says is
he claims that his wife is a Christian. He claims that he has all this stuff.
If you Pamela Jeller and just look up what everything that's written about this guy through the years, he has the ears of people really high, and he's a very dangerous.
He's a dangerous man because he's a good writer. He's a good writer because I was reading through much of this and going, wow, he really said that well. But as someone who has read a number of liberal scholarship books about Jesus, especially Dominic Crossan and other people from the Jesus Seminar and others, he's just simply regurgitating what's been said for many years. The book's claim is essentially that the whole thing is a conspiracy theory that Jesus was really a proclaimer of violent revolution, and the Gospels and Paul covered it up. He also claims that the peaceful divine Jesus was made up by Paul, and that Peter and James sharply opposed Paul's claim that Jesus was divine. Another interesting comment, he says, it's interesting that he is highly selective on which verses he will quote, and he ignores ones that don't help his position. For example, he's willing to accept the gospel's testimony, whatever it helps him. He accepts the historicity of a saying like, I have not come to bring peace but a sword, and the kingdom of God suffers violence and the violence take it by force. But then he ignores the context of both sayings, which have nothing to do with violent revolution. He dismisses the gospel's account of Jesus' arrest as entirely fictional and does not accept that Jesus stopped Peter from using the sword. Aslan is quite willing to accept that Luke was correct when he recorded Jesus saying, let no one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. And this pattern of selective exegesis is repeated over and over in this book. It is simply an unfair and extremely biased treatment of the historical evidence. It presents Aslan as somehow having secret knowledge that allows him to correctly identify when the four evangelists were accurate and when they were fabricating, when in reality the author is simply ignoring most of the evidence against his theory. So if anybody in your workplace or in your circle of friends says, we need to read this great book together, just let them know. It has nothing to do, even his background, but the material that's in here, it's just simply old, very tired liberal scholarship that says Jesus doesn't know who he said he was. And, you know, so why believe in him? That's the whole point. But the reason I brought it up is that we have this period of history where this is going on while Herod has died. And could this there have been some influence? Well, no, not necessarily in that way. It makes, to me, it makes Jesus' message even that much more radical, because it flew right in the face of all the revolutionaries that surrounded him, that he grew up with. His message wasn't only to the Pharisees saying, you guys got it wrong. He's saying to the revolutionaries around him, you've got it wrong too. The kingdom of God is not going to be here. Let me get it straight. Somebody's ringing. It's you.
Who's this? That sounds the same ring as mine. I'm sorry.
That's all right. So I find these scholarship discussions really kind of fascinating, because they're simply attempting to break down Jesus as who he said he was. That thing will never stop ringing.
Well, it will. But it's very noisy, so it does. And then it continues to be noisy if they use messages.
One last thing before I pray, just because I want to end our time. I don't want to have to come back to this. Go into column 3 on your chart. Will you see a double line? That's a marriage. So Herod the Great marries Miriam the Second. They have a child named Herod Philip. You with me? And then it says, boy, that's not a good table. Then you have a double line, which meant Herod Philip married Herodias, who has a child named Salome. Do those two names mean anything to you? Yeah, Matthew 14, the beheading of John the Baptist. That's them. Now, to find Herodias, you have to go to column 2. Mariamne the First, Alexander and Aristobulus, right? You see that? Aristobulus marries Bernice. They have 4 children, so the line goes way down to the bottom of the page and then spreads out, and the 4 children are Mariamne. No, it's not the other two. It's a third Mariamne. Thank you very much. Aristobulus, no, it's not the Aristobulus who was killed. This is a son. Herod Agrippa, who later became in charge of everything. In fact, this Herod Agrippa was the one that Paul talked to. And then a daughter named Herodias. Herodias marries Herod Philip in column 3. It's the same one. Halfway through her marriage with Herod Philip, she decides she doesn't like him. So she divorces Herod Philip and marries Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is in the 4th column, and he's the Herod who executed John the Baptist. What a dysfunctional family. You got daughters marrying half-brothers. And when John the Baptist, it says in Matthew that when he is brought before Herod Antipas, she, Herodias, doesn't like him because he said you should not be married to him, and made a very public shamefulness, shame on you for doing this. And it's because of this connection, this weird family connection. It's very confusing, because you've got 3 Mariamnes. The chart shows 2 different Herodiases, but she's the same one. She's just in different places, because she, you know, slept around. Fascinating. This brings us to the end and conclusion of the Herod era, and really brings us right into the New Testament. I'm not quite sure what we're going to be doing the next couple weeks. I'm still working on that.
You could review all this. We'd still remember.
We'd still try to remember it all. I mean, it's hard enough when I've got the notes. I mean, this is really quite extraordinary. Let's pray so we can get over to the sanctuary for our service. Lord, thank you for our time together. So much history, so much detail, so many extraordinary movement, and yet the secular powers were so lost. And this setup was for the perfect time for you to come into a kingdom and talk to both the religious leaders and to the revolutionaries and to the secular people and say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And it was such a radical message that only a few really truly understood it because of all this stuff around them. Thank you for helping us understand that and see this. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.